Chapter 7. Trip after trip, as correct as clockwork. At last he murmured again, in sight yet? The sun makes a very great glare, Tuan.
Watch well, Serang.
Yeah, Tuan. A white man had ascended the ladder from the deck noiselessly, and had listened quietly to this short colloquy. Then he stepped out on the bridge, and began to walk from end to end, holding up the long cherry wood stem of a pipe. His black hair lay plastered in long lanky wisps across the bald summit of his head. He had a furrowed brow, a yellow complexion, and a thick shapeless nose. A scanty growth of whisker did not conceal the contour of his jaw. His aspect was of brooding care, and sucking at a curved black mouthpiece, he presented such a heavy overhanging profile that even the Serang could not help reflecting sometimes upon the extreme unloveliness of some white men. Captain Wally seemed to brace himself up in his chair, but gave no recognition whatever to his presence. The other puffed jets of smoke. Then suddenly, I could never understand that new mania of yours of having this Malay here for your shadow, partner. Captain Wally got up from the chair in all his imposing stature, and walked across to the binnacle, holding such an unswerving course, that the other had to back away hurriedly, and remained as if intimidated, with the pipe trembling in his hand. Walk over me now, he muttered in a sort of astounded and discomfited whisper. Then slowly and distinctly he said, I am not dirt. And then added defiantly, as you seem to think. The Serang jerked out, see the palms now, Tuan. Captain Wally strode forward to the rail, but his eyes, instead of going straight to the point, with the assured keen glance of a sailor, wandered irresolutely in space, as though he, the discoverer of new routes, had lost his way upon this narrow sea. Another white man, the mate, came up on the bridge. He was tall, young, lean, with a mustache like a trooper, and something malicious in the eye. He took up a position beside the engineer. Captain Wally, with his back to them, inquired, what's on the log? 85, answered the mate quickly, and nudged the engineer with his elbow. Captain Wally's muscular hand squeezed the iron rail with an extraordinary force. His eyes glared with an enormous effort. He knitted his eyebrows. The perspiration fell from under his hat, and in a faint voice he murmured, steady her, Serang, when she is on the proper bearing. The silent Malay stepped back, waited a little, and lifted his arm warningly to the helmsman. The wheel revolved rapidly to meet the swing of the ship. Again the mate nudged the engineer. But Massey turned upon him. Mr. Stern, he said violently, let me tell you as a shipowner, that you are no better than a confounded fool. Wyatt Stern went down smirking, and apparently not at all disconcerted, but the engineer Massey remained on the bridge, moving about with uneasy self-assertion. Everybody on board was his inferior, everyone without exception. He paid their wages, and found them in their food. They ate more of his bread, and pocketed more of his money than they were worth, and they had no care in the world, while he alone had to meet all the difficulties of shipowning. When he contemplated his position in all its menacing entirety, it seemed to him that he had been for years the prey of a band of parasites, and for years he had scowled at everybody connected with the Cephala except, perhaps, at the Chinese firemen who served to get along. Their use was manifest. They were an indispensable part of the machinery, of which he was the master. When he passed along his decks he shouldered those he came across brutally, but the Malay deckhands had learned to dodge out of his way. He had to bring himself to tolerate them, because of the necessary manual labor of the ship which must be done. He had to struggle, and plan and scheme to keep the Cephala afloat, and what did he get for it? Not even enough respect. They could not have given him enough of that, if all their thoughts and all their actions had been directed to that end. The vanity of possession, the vainglory of power, had passed away by this time, and there remained only the material embarrassments,
the fear of losing that position which had turned out not worth having, and an anxiety of thought which no abject subservience of men could repay. He walked up and down. The bridge was his own after all. He had paid for it, and with the stem of the pipe in his hand he would stop short at times, as if to listen with a profound and concentrated attention to the deadened beat of the engines, his own engines, and the slight grinding of the steering chains upon the continuous low wash of water alongside. But for these sounds, the ship might have been lying as still as if moored to a bank, and as silent as if abandoned by every living soul. Only the coast, the low coast of mud and mangroves with the three palms, in a bunch at the back, grew slowly more distinct in its long straight line, without a single feature to arrest attention. The native passengers of the Sofala lay about on mats under the awnings. The smoke of her funnel seemed the only sign of her life, and connected with her gliding motion in a mysterious manner. Captain Wally on his feet, with a pair of binoculars in his hand, and the little Malay Serang at his elbow, like an old giant attended by a wizened pygmy, was tacking her over the shallow water of the bar. This submarine ridge of mud, scoured by the stream out of the soft bottom of the river, and heaped up far out on the hard bottom of the sea, was difficult to get over. The alluvial coast having no distinguishing marks, the bearings of the crossing place had to be taken from the shape of the mountains inland. The guidance of a form flattened and uneven at the top like a grinder tooth, and of another smooth, saddle-back summit, had to be searched for within the great unclouded glare that seemed to shift and float like a dry fiery mist, filling the air, ascending from the water, shrouding the distances, scorching to the eye. In this veil of light the near edge of the shore alone stood out almost coal black with an opaque and motionless solidity. 30 miles away the serrated range of the interior stretched across the horizon, its outlines and shades of blue, faint and tremulous like a background painted on airy gossamer on the quivering fabric of an impalpable curtain, let down to the plain of alluvial soil, and the openings of the estuary appeared, shining white, like bits of silver let into the square pieces snipped clean and sharp out of the body of the land beordered with mangroves. On the forepart of the bridge the giant and the pygmy muttered to each other frequently in quiet tones. Behind the mass he stood sideways with an expression of disdain and suspense on his face. His globular eyes were perfectly motionless, and he seemed to have forgotten the long pipe he held in his hand. On the foredeck below the bridge, steeply roofed with the white slopes of the awnings, a young Lascar seaman had clambered outside the rail. He adjusted quickly a broad band of sail canvas under his armpits, and throwing his chest against it, leaned out far over the water. The sleeves of his thin cotton shirt, cut off close to the shoulder, bared his brown arm of full-rounded form, and with a satiny skin like a woman's. He swung it rigidly with the rudderly and menacing action of a slinger. The 14 pounds weight hurtled circling in the air, then suddenly flew ahead as far as the curve of the bow. The wet thin line swished like scratched silk running through the dark fingers of the man, and the plunge of the lead close to the ship's side made a vanishing silvery scar upon the golden glitter. Then after an interval the voice of the young Malay uplifted, and long-drawn declared the depth of the water in his own language. "Tigastenga," he cried after each splash and pause, gathering the line busily for another cast. "Igastenga," which means 3 fathom and a half. For a mile or so from seaward there was a uniform depth of water right up to the bar. L3, half 3, half 3, and his modulated cry returned leisurely and monotonous, like the repeated call of a bird, seemed to float away in sunshine and disappear in the spacious silence of the empty sea and of a lifeless shore lying open, north and south, east and west, without the stir of a single cloud shadow or the whisper of any other voice. The owner engineer of the Sofala remained very still behind the two seamen of different race, creed, and color, the European with the time-defying vigor of his old frame, the little Malay, old too, but slight and shrunken like a withered brown leaf blown by a chance wind under the mighty shadow of the other. Very busy looking forward at the land, they had not a glance to spare, and Massey, glaring at them from behind, seemed to resent their attention to their duty like a personal slight upon himself. This was unreasonable, but he had lived in his own world of unreasonable resentments for many years. At last, passing his moist palm over the rare lanky wisps of coarse hair on the top of his yellow head, he began to talk slowly. "A leadsman, you want? I suppose that's your correct mail boat style. Haven't you enough judgment to tell where you are by looking at the land? Why, before I had been a 12-month in the trade I was up to that trick, and I am only an engineer. I can point to you from here where the bar is, and I could tell you besides, that you are as likely as not to stick her in the mud in about 5 minutes from now, only you would call it interfering, I suppose. And there's that written agreement of ours, that says I mustn't interfere." His voice stopped. Captain Wally, without relaxing the set severity of his features, moved his lips to ask in a quick mumble, "How near, Serang?" "Very near now, Tuan," the Malay muttered rapidly. "Dead slow," said the captain aloud in a firm tone. The Serang snatched at the handle of the telegraph. A gong clanged down below. Massey with a scornful snigger walked off, and put his head down the engine room skylight. "You may expect some rare fooling with the engines, Jack," he bellowed. The space into which he stared was deep and full of gloom, and the gray gleams of steel down there seemed cool after the intense glare of the sea around the ship. The air, however, came up clammy and hot on his face. A short hoot on which it would have been impossible to put any sort of interpretation came from the bottom cavernously. This was the way in which the second engineer answered his chief. He was a middle-aged man with an inattentive manner, and apparently wrapped up in such a taciturn concern for his engines that he seemed to have lost the use of speech. When addressed directly, his only answer would be a grunt or a hoot, according to the distance. For all the years he had been in the Sofala, he had never been known to exchange as much as a frank good morning with any of his shipmates. He did not seem aware that men came and went in the world. He did not seem to see them at all. Indeed, he never recognized his shipmates on shore. At table, the four white men of the Sofala messed together. He sat looking into his plate dispassionately, but at the end of the meal, would jump up and bolt down below, as if a sudden thought had impelled him to rush and see whether somebody had not stolen the engines while he dined. In port at the end of the trip he went ashore regularly, but no one knew where he spent his evenings or in what manner. The local coasting fleet had preserved a wild and incoherent tale of his infatuation for the wife of a sergeant in an Irish infantry regiment. The regiment, however, had done its turn of garrison duty there ages before, and was gone somewhere to the other side of the earth, out of men's knowledge. Twice or perhaps three times in the course of the year he would take too much to drink. On these occasions he returned on board at an earlier hour than usual, ran across the deck balancing himself with his spread arms like a tightrope walker, and locking the door of his cabin, he would converse and argue with himself the livelong night in an amazing variety of tones, storm, sneer, and whine with an inexhaustible persistence. Massey in his berth next door, raising himself on his elbow, would discover that his second had remembered the name of every white man that had passed through the Sofala for years and years back. He remembered the names of men that had died, that had gone home, that had gone to America. He remembered in his cups the names of men whose connection with the ship had been so short that Massey had almost forgotten its circumstances and could barely recall their faces. The inebriated voice on the other side of the bulkhead commented upon them all with an extraordinary and ingenious venom of scandalous inventions. It seems they had all offended him in some way, and in return he had found them all out. He muttered, "Gutenberg edition." End of chapter.